Greetings, film freaks. We are the Podcorn Kernels. Join us as we discuss the hard and often indigestible truths that are at the center of the fluffy and delicious world of cinema.
What's popping, people? Welcome to the Podcorn Kernels podcast. My name is Adam, and joining me in your ear holes is Harry. Say hello, Harry.
Why Will Smith like boiled egg?
On today's episode, we will be talking about Phantom Thread. This is a 2017 film directed by Paul Thomas Anderson and stars Vicky Krieps, Daniel Day-Lewis, and Leslie Manville. IMDb describes the synopsis as follows. Set in 1950s London, Reynolds Woodcock is a renowned dressmaker whose fastidious life is disrupted by a young, strong-willed woman. Here is an original song to support the synopsis.
Alma, make me some tea, so you can hurt me. Let me tailor your soul. I want complete control, famous for dress design. Make my health decline, mummy mushroom girl, you make me hurt. Mummy mushroom girl, you make me hurt.
Butter. Let's start with some facts about the film. This is allegedly Daniel Day-Lewis's final film. He announced on June 20th, 2017, that he was retiring from acting. What do you think about that?
Attention seeker, looking for his comeback 10 years down the line so everyone comes to it.
You reckon?
I don't know.
I'm leaning towards believing that that's it for him. For someone who's so picky about the roles that he chooses and is so dedicated to each role, I feel that someone like him coming out and going, you know what, that's me done, I think that will be the last we see of him in acting. I'd be interested to see if he did any writing or directing. I'd love to see him behind a camera. If he had that same mentality, that same obsessive nature in creating a film rather than creating a character.
Did he say films or did he say acting?
Retiring from acting.
Okay, so he won't even do a miniseries.
I'm assuming not.
Okay.
I think it's a real shame because he's one of the biggest talents, in my opinion, to ever grace the screen.
He is, yeah, but I think how serious he takes it, I think that's probably not being respected as much as it used to. Because now a lot of actors pull that method out the bag, don't they?
Yeah.
We get to the point where you've got, is it Jared Leto being method, and he's like the front of an emo band, you know, and he does trash films, but he's method and does extremely well at Dallas Buyers Club. And it's almost like, oh, I have a little jab at that this week. And then next week, I'll go to Japan and do a concert or something. It's just like, but this was Daniel Day-Lewis's bread and butter method. You go all the way back to My Left Foot, and he was already applying that genius then. Now, probably frowned upon to impersonate or act through a disabled role, but I still thought it was an excellent performance. And I'm sad to not be able to think of him in the future for a role. I just wouldn't agree with the last couple of films he chose to go out on, really.
Yeah, it's intriguing, isn't it? Because I think there's something to be said about lesser talents like Jared Leto taking the same process as Day-Lewis, and it maybe does dilute it. So whereas before, Daniel Day-Lewis was out in front of everyone else, really getting involved, really letting the roles absorb him and all of that. Now it's become more popular practice. It feels like that thing that set him apart doesn't anymore. And that's maybe why he's trying to wash his hands of it and leave with his legacy intact.
Do you know why I respected his method? Because it was more about the feel and the internal structure of the character. He was never into like, oh, I'm going to gain 40 stone, I'm going to lose 20 stone. You know, he stays very similar in his stature throughout his film repertoire. If you look at it, you know, he was a little bit toned for Last of the Mohicans. Mm. He was a bit thin for My Left Foot. But, you know, it's called acting for a reason. I've always believed this. I think if you're naturally a 16 stone man, that's your height, that's your size. You don't see the likes of Brad Pitt and Tom Cruise gain like 60 stone, lose 60 stone to do a role. But then when you do see actors do it, I don't know, a part of me feels like, you know, you actually risk your own health for a role. Do what Day-Lewis does.
Yeah.
You know, take the roles that are written, but do it internally.
Yeah.
Make your character you internally. I get it with accents. I get it with physicality. I've never been a fan of the Bale jumping between 40 stone and 20. I've never been a fan of it.
I admire Christian Bale, what he does by transforming his body based on the role, but I can completely understand where people like yourself may think it's about changing the character, changing the characteristics, how you act, like you say, how the voices, the mannerisms, all of that stuff. That should be enough. And that's why Daniel Day-Lewis is considered one of the best, because he just focuses on that, I think. The next fact's quite a lengthy one, so bear with me. In preparation for the film, Daniel Day-Lewis watched archival footage of 1940s and 1950s fashion shows, studied famous designers, consulted with the curator of fashion and textiles at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, and apprenticed under Mark Happel, head of the costume department at the New York City Ballet. He also learned how to sew, and he practiced on his wife, Rebecca Miller, trying to recreate a Balenciaga, I think that's how you say it, sheath dress that was inspired by a school uniform. Now, that's a lot. That's a lot to take in as a fact, but I included every inch of it, every word of it, because that just shows the man's commitment to the role. Mm-hmm. And for me, when I read stuff like that, I am impressed. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're on the same page with me on that one.
Yeah, of course. Well, that's what I'm saying. Like, he goes down a process that I think's better in terms of showing your character. Like, he couldn't have done much for Lincoln because it's very hard to pretend to be a president in your normal day life. But, like, I know that he did, like, butchery work and everything for Build a Butcher in Gangs of New York. And obviously, My Left Foot, I know he visited, like, Orpheus centres and stuff where cerebral palsy was, you know, kids were being treated for cerebral palsy. And I thought that was a respectful way to do it. You know, he went and looked at the source material, the real life scenario, and then applied that to his work. So I think that's very expected of him to take that angle.
Do you think it's overkill doing that much? Because I would suggest that the argument is, if you're a good enough actor, you shouldn't have to go and learn how to sew. You shouldn't have to go and do this huge body of research to really encapsulate the character, to really feel the beats and everything of this character.
I think if you'd put any other actor in his place and said, this is your character, this is what they're going to reveal, this is their passion, they probably could have done it just the same, at a similar level, like without all of that background work, without all of that commitment. Because in the film, in essence, apart from him do a couple of scribbles on a bit of paper and, you know, move some dresses around, tell someone to stand a certain way, he never actually gets a chance to show off that knowledge that I suppose he learnt.
It makes me wonder if doing all of that background work is for him, not necessarily for the audience. So if he feels more comfortable in the shoes of the person he's playing, he might feel within himself he can deliver a better performance. I don't know, but I'm assuming that's why.
Yeah, that's his modus operandi, isn't it? He found a way a long time ago when he started getting juicier roles that he wanted to really do him justice, and it sort of became his unique sign-off. You know, I don't think he sent Spielberg an old-fashioned tape when he got the part for Lincoln in a letter with a skull and crossbones on it, which was like, death upon opening. If someone got it and it weren't Spielberg, you don't open this under pain of death or something. And it was his voice of how he imagined Lincoln through reading books and books and books about the speeches Lincoln delivered. And they surmised and figured out that Lincoln must have had a high pitch to have been heard in these huge places where he'd give speeches. So when he gave the Gettysburg Address, if he was low, bassy, it wouldn't travel far enough. People wouldn't hear it as well. So they knew he had a higher voice. That's why in the film he's like, now.
I love that. The name Reynolds Woodcock began as a joke suggested by Daniel Day-Lewis to director Paul Thomas Anderson. The name made Anderson laugh so hard that he cried, cementing its presence in the script. Now, for an actor like we've discussed who's so serious, so driven, so resolute in performing the best he can, it does make me laugh that he found the name Reynolds Woodcock funny.
And inside joke?
Well, I'm assuming it's just because his surname's Woodcock. It's just a cock, isn't it?
I'm assuming that.
But for it to make the cut because they found the name funny.
Was they high?
Maybe, I don't know. I just found it interesting that both Daniel Day-Lewis and Paul Thomas Anderson are quite well-respected, obviously, and almost
very serious.
They seem very serious, straight-laced. So to hear that they found a name that they deemed humorous and put it in, it seemed really odd, especially when the film was in no way, shape, or form a comedy.
Well, I might have to have more of a longer read on that.
Yeah.
That's quite interesting. Because, you're right. I mean, you see Day-Lewis at an awards ceremony. He's so professional and so...
Yeah.
He's got his received pronunciation going on and his heart. It's all very heartfelt. And then, you know, when Jack Nicholson and Robin Williams come on, they just lose it. And it's like the contrast between how serious he takes his work and how Jack Nicholson does. Mm. Like, there's a great award ceremony if you have the opportunity to have a look at it. It's brilliant.
Yeah, I've seen that clip. It's hilarious.
And he looks awkward because it's like, oh, they're having a real laugh and a joke and I'm all like, my mother.
Yeah. It just shows the levels that go into being a talented actor, because all three are amazing at what they do. Mm. I consider all three of them some of the best actors to ever existed. So to see the difference and the contrast between Day-Lewis taking it so seriously and the other two just pissing around and having a laugh. I'm pretty sure Jack Nicholson was steaming drunk by the time he got up on stage. Yeah, it's definitely a clip worth checking out. Mm. What did you like about the film?
I'll go with a short one first. I'd say in the first part of the film, you get a very odd feeling that Daniel Day-Lewis is quite toxic and quite parasitic. And there's something about him that makes me feel a bit off, like the way he sits and he looks down on girlfriends and partners because they're eating loudly and stuff. And I think this guy's like going to be a nightmare.
Yeah.
Then the second half, you start to think Alma's the issue. She's the parasite. And it starts to get a bit like, I'm actually really lost. I don't know who's actually going to be the issue. And then in the end, you realize that they're symbiotic and they're helping each other.
Yeah.
So what I took from that, even when you watch the film, there's so mushrooms play a big part in this film, fungus. Early on in the film, Alma is in the country retreat of Reynolds's estate. And she gets told about a mushroom that can make you very ill or very sick. And it has like, I think it's a yellow stainer. And obviously there's ones out there that look like yellow stainers, like chanterelles, which you can eat and stuff. But yellow stainers, she finds out quite early that it makes you ill. Now, I have a little anecdote for this. I said it would be a short one. It's not. It's going to be the long one. But my anecdote is, so I went to the Peak District last year for a wedding, and I went on a hike, and I came across this ford, and there's this huge beech tree. It had bridged the water and fallen over, so it became like a natural bridge across the water. Now, this tree was covered in these tiny, really beautiful, they look like little ballerina dresses, and they're called Udumantiella massida, and they're porcelain fungus. Do you want another name for porcelain fungus?
Go on.
Poached egg fungus.
Really?
And the first thing he orders and his first interaction with the girl is a poached egg.
Oh, right. Right?
Now, bear with me because I'm really speculating.
It's foreshadowing, maybe?
Well, that's just a mad theory.
Okay.
But mushrooms is actually a really strong, you could definitely argue it's a strong subtext in this film, because porcelain fungus give off a fungicide which makes other mushrooms fuck off, right?
Oh.
She didn't want anyone around him.
Yeah.
She enclosed him in a room and she gave a fungicide. She gets them all off, right? Porcelain fungus are considered beautiful. Beech trees are considered strong, huge, ominous presence, right? But porcelain fungus are slightly parasitic to beech trees, which means they can bring them down.
Wow.
Yeah. But they also are mycorrhizal, which means they live symbiotically, which means they can feed each other. Wow. So my weird thing about mushrooms in the film, the fact that they're the porcelain fungus, this, and the porcelain fungus gives off a fungicide, makes other mushrooms can't go near this tree.
Yeah.
This is my tree. And the way that they're both parasitic to each other, but by the end, they're mycorrhizal and figure out that they actually
work better together.
And then my partner said, Phantom Fred, do you think that's like mycelium? Because Fred, if you see mycelium under the ground, it's these tiny like cotton string under the ground. And she said it's hidden, phantom, under the ground, thread, mycelium. Whoa. So I walked out the film with this huge fungus thing going on.
Yeah, you've blown my mind.
Well, that's what was in my mind. But I also had the whole thing I had going on up in the Peak District and looking at this mushroom on this tree and stuff. And it just freaked me out. And then I looked at the film and I thought, well, mushrooms are in the film. The camera focuses on this poached egg at the start, and I'm like, well, that Udumantiella massida is also called poached egg fungus.
That's amazing, man.
And then I shat myself because I thought my other half knows poisonous mushrooms, and Alma is kind of like her.
Wow.
Terrifying.
So it's insightful and intimidating at the same time.
Yeah.
I think that's a fascinating point. I'm so glad you shared it. You're coming across as like someone who's got a sniff of a serial killer case, and you've got all the like red lace on the walls with loads of different photos trying to piece it all together. I really hope that Paul Thomas Anderson has got that level of background to the story.
Well, since you said that he laughed at Woodcock, I don't think he
maybe
does.
Not. Maybe doesn't go that deep. But that's fascinating, man. I yeah. Good job. What else did you like about the film?
I loved that he puts himself down for breakfast about six times in a film and didn't enjoy one of them breakfasts. Anyone eating, moving, talking, he's annoyed. Yeah. I can relate a lot to noisy ears. It is irritating.
Yeah,
but like, don't put yourself in that situation. If you don't want to hear someone slurp or...
Yeah.
And he's just getting annoyed and I was like feeling his anger. But at the same time, I felt sorry for the poor girl that wanted to... Yeah. Alma wants to have some toast and that.
Yeah.
And I thought it was hilarious. Every meal, this guy's annoyed. He has a dinner on their honeymoon later on in the film. And she, all of a sudden, it's like she's knowingly doing it now. Because they're married now. She's sort of won her battle, which happens well before the third act, I suppose. And because she's married him, and this is the one thing he avoids throughout the film. This is what the impression you get off this guy is he doesn't want commitment. He doesn't want to marry anyone because he fears that's what will blunt his edge.
Mm.
And he'll stop being the best dressmaker in the world. But anyway, yeah, when he marries her, she starts slurping a bit louder and you can't help but think it's...
spiteful.
Yeah.
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 Yeah, there's a lot of that in the film, like your mega mushroom analogy. Like there's things that they clearly do that you look at and they shouldn't work together, but then you question, can they work without each other? And it's that balance for the whole film on whether or not they are suited because no one else could deal with them, or if it's just toxic and they should both be running in opposite directions. Mm. Do you have any other things you liked about the film?
I probably moved away from the first thing I said in my like. So when I said it rewards you for being patient.
Yeah.
Short story without all the mushroom talk, the fungi talk, was that it's very easy to watch this film and think it's a very, very cut and dry Fatal Attraction or War of the Roses. You just think the girl's going to move in into his life and then start ruining it. I thought at one point she was going to kill the sister. So Cyril in this film is Reynolds' sister.
Are they siblings?
Yeah, brother and sister.
Are you certain of this?
Yes, absolutely.
Oh, I had no idea.
Why not?
I thought it was his PA.
No, it's his sister, yeah, Cyril. It's because she's also called Cyril Woodcock.
Oh. I believe you.
Let me get up.
You're educating me left, right and centre in this one.
No,
I appreciate it.
Yeah, it's his sister. Yeah, it is his sister.
Oh, that makes a lot more sense.
The fact that I'm watching it, and because of that first half where you start to think Alma's character is... No, second half, she seems like she's twisted. Because obviously you see her do this with a mushroom. Essentially, she makes Reynolds ill halfway through the film.
Yeah, I'd say so. Yeah.
About halfway through, she makes him ill and then obviously gets this opportunity to mother him. And that's very big for his character because he loves, adores and misses his dead mum.
Mm.
So you only think that she's trying to control him. She's getting him in a room. She's poisoning him. So straight away, I'm like, oh, this is a very cut and dry thriller where he's obviously this really powerful, revered man and she's jealous and she wants to bring him down.
Yeah.
Why I say patience rewards you in this film is because in the last 15 minutes... It totally turns that theory on its head.
Yeah.
And essentially what it reveals is that they're both as bad as each other.
Exactly.
But also both like that aspect of each other.
Yeah. Very, so, very bizarre film.
You have to watch it all.
Yeah.
Yeah. You couldn't like instantly go, music's great.
Yeah.
You couldn't instantly go, great opening. It takes time.
It builds, doesn't it?
Yeah.
And like you say, you are certainly rewarded by watching it from beginning to end. When the film starts, I thought the story, I may have looked at it a bit differently to you, but I thought Vicky Crepe's character falls for this amazing dress designer who's very set in his ways. And I thought it'd be a case of her getting involved in his world and her being the victim, her not knowing what she signed up for, because the Daniel Day-Lewis's character is very charming, very well spoken, just it looks like the full package. And then the more you learn about him, you know, you get to learn he's really difficult and obnoxious, toxic, brutal. And I thought, okay, so this is a film of a woman falling for a man who she deems to be above her station, and it turns out that he's an absolute nightmare. And the film for me takes a really interesting turn when it lets the audience have a level of uncertainty of who's the antagonist, who's the protagonist. I'd argue that they're both of those things all at once. They're both the good guy, they're both the bad guy, and it's the battle between them for power, control and all of that stuff. So I thought it was a really fascinating film that, like you say, it does reward its audience. You got to stick with it though, because it's quite a slow start, I thought.
Yeah.
My favourite thing about the film was at its core, there's a tripod of talent. I thought Daniel Day-Lewis, Vicky Crepes and Leslie Manville were all excellent in their respective roles. Each of their characters was both a strength and a weakness to the other characters. And the ever-evolving dynamic between the three made for an intriguing watch. Now, I didn't clock that they were siblings, Daniel Day-Lewis and Leslie Manville's characters. I just thought that she was a PA that was just used to his shit. Mm-hmm. But now knowing what I know that they are related, you can see why she gets away with saying what she says. She's not businessing with him. She's like, oh, shut up, like, fuck off, all of that, because they know each other so well. And in a film where it's mainly only those three in it, really, that have anything important to do, it's that ever-changing relationship between the trio that I thought was really fascinating.
It's a power struggle, isn't it?
Yeah, continuously. And you've got Leslie Manville's character almost as like a background character, but you could argue she's the most important one because she bridges Reynolds Woodcock's difficulties with clients and that. She's the front-facing person to deal with all of his absurdities and all of that stuff.
He's there for the flourish, isn't he?
Yeah, and she offers like a bit of relief to Alma, played by Vicky Krieps. And yeah, the whole dynamic between the three of them I found really interesting. I also liked, similar to what you said, how it's a slow story, but it was quick to engage. Mm-hmm. So it starts off very slow and you kind of make your mind up where the film's going. But I found it amazing how such a quiet and slow film was able to be so captivating and engrossing. Because I don't know about you, but a lot of the film, it's really civilized conversation, really quiet moments. When Reynolds Woodcock is being particularly difficult, it's quite rare that he loses his temper. He says really quiet, biting comments. And considering this isn't a film that's action-packed, it's not necessarily dialogue-heavy, not a lot happens in terms of plot. It's just them trying to get one up on each other. I found the whole thing to be really engaging. I don't know if you agree, but I was completely captivated by the whole film.
Only on finishing it.
Yeah.
Did I probably see value in...
In hindsight.
Yeah, in hindsight, definitely.
Mm. I also liked the relationship between Alma and Reynolds. I was fascinated how their relationship evolved. It went from curiosity and infatuation to obsession and control. It's a portrayal of toxicity at its finest, and their arc as a couple working together, I found really intriguing and interesting because they're all trying to, as I've mentioned, all trying to get one up on the other, fight for control. And one part I was like, I was team Woodcock, then the other part I was team Alma.
Yeah.
And right up until the end, until they, you kind of understand that they're on this same really fucking strange page. Mm-hmm. I was still never really knew where my alliances laid. So I enjoyed that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What elements of the film didn't you like so much?
The first dress you see him make, the first one that is revealed to you and shows you this guy's supreme talent, I thought was a right letdown. I don't know much about dresses, but it was dull, dreary. I didn't think it looked great. And I thought, you know, you want to blow your audience away with this film based on this extremely talented dressmaker. I wanted to see something sharp, something really striking. And I think Gina McGee, I think the actress is.
No idea.
I think I wrote it down somewhere. She was in Foresight Saga with Damien Lewis. But she's the first person that wears one of his dresses. And she's also the customer who later on in the film is revealed that she's gone to another house.
Okay.
So she's your foreshadowing at the start of his downfall, I suppose. Mm. Because at the start, she wears his first ever dress and she goes to an event. And it's not flattering and it was quite dull and it didn't look right. I mean, it's post-50s, post-World War II. Later on in the film, you see much nicer designs and dresses that he makes.
Do you think that's deliberate? So the dresses improve once the introduction of Alma is there, and she's like his muse when it starts, isn't
he? He's supposed to be works at better. His best.
That's true. He's already established when the film starts as this well-renowned, highly respected dressmaker. Mm. I must admit, I don't remember the dress. I didn't have any opinion on whether the dress was nice or not.
That's my point. You should.
Yeah.
Because
introduction to
at the core of it all is supposed to be his talent. Mm. You know, the one thing he can do, which makes the whole world gush for him, is dresses. And that first one just didn't blow me away.
Was it like a burgundy colour or my?
It's like purple.
Roughly,
It was purple. It looked quite loose. It didn't drop very nice.
It didn't scream perfection.
No, it didn't. It didn't show off like nice collar line, shoulders, or anything. There was just. It wasn't like, wow, I thought it would be a really good point in the film that's early on to show what this guy can do. So then you're invested in his work.
Yeah.
I was like, yeah.
Oh, so, I know you watched it with your partner. Did she share an opinion as a woman if she liked the dress or was it?
Unflattering, ugly.
Really?
Yeah. Later on, though, there was much prettier dresses.
Oh, fair enough. Anything else you didn't like about the film?
The most dislikable characters I've ever seen in a film. I couldn't find a quality in any of the characters that I liked. And by that, I mean, they're obviously doing their job well. But Daniel Day-Lewis's character is extremely elitist, extremely
arrogant,
delicate sort of artist, which, yeah. You know, I can't stand sometimes that whole look at the work I'm doing, look how important it is. No, you're not clothing orphans. You're not feeding the starving. So you're making a dress for elite rich people. And it's like the way he breaks down because it's so hard. And it's like, no. It's hard to watch a film where three people are three characters as human beings are not people I would like to associate with.
No, and they all have delusions of grandeur, don't they?
Yeah.
They all think they're the shit and that everyone else is beneath them. And from a audience perspective, like, who am I rooting for here? Like you say, exactly. Like, I'm not there going, ah, oh, that Reynolds, he's a laugh, or oh, poor Alma, like, oh, I hope he gets her comeuppance. Like, by the end of it, you don't have any well wishes for any of them, really.
Well, it reeks of snobbery and elitism.
Yes.
And it's so hard to fall in line or be compassionate towards his plight or struggle as a millionaire dressmaker, Alma's plight or struggle as, you know, she's got into this world from being a waitress down in Cornwall. That leads me into my other dislike. There is no backstory into Alma on how she came into being. Like, she's at a B&B, he sees her, he orders six breakfasts, porcelain fungi breakfast.
Yep.
And that's it, she's in his life. And there's no backstory, she's got an accent, you don't know what country she's from. I don't recall them saying what country she's from. And then she's just in his life, and it's... I don't know. Is it intentional? Is it to make you think, who is this person? Is she trying to overthrow the throne of or the house of Woodcock?
Yeah, I think it might be intentional, because she's this mysterious entity that comes into his life, and she's a very beautiful woman. She's clearly got a sense of humor. She's seems to be this individual, and it's just him and her really in this place where he's getting breakfast. And the fact we don't know anything, it shows that he's just initially attracted to something about her, and he wants to investigate that further. He's not really interested in finding out who she is. He sees her as this muse, and is just infatuated by her, and believes that the journey of discovering who she is isn't about connecting on an emotional level. It's about him being able to use this as a source of feeling able to create new stuff, being inspired. Yeah. That's the word I was looking for. Feel inspired by her. So using her to create these amazing dresses. So I think we're not meant to know much about her. Mm-hmm. But then that does play into the fact that they're so unlikable, because we know nothing really about them other than they're obnoxious, spoiled, brattish, all of these things. Yeah,
it's a fair point. I suppose he's hardened prior to the film beginning because of the loss of his mum.
Yeah.
So that's essential to his character arc, is the loss of his mum.
Yeah. And that's what he's struggling with. And we find out later in the film is probably what he's trying to replace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anything else you didn't like about it?
No.
No. Okay. Well, my first dislike ties in basically with what you said, and I just didn't like Reynolds Woodcock. Whilst there is no doubt that Day-Lewis was exceptional in the role, the character of Woodcock was not a likeable one. Stubborn, egotistical, and continuously difficult, I found it hard to care when he was faced with peril. We've touched on that already. Marked as read, just no one was really likeable in it, and he topped the list of unlikability, I feel.
Have you ever said that about Daniel Day-Lewis in a film? I've never said that.
Even when he's a dickhead, like Daniel Plainview in There Will Be Blood.
There's
Bill
layers.
The Butcher in Gangs of New York.
Yeah.
He's the villain in those films, but you're still
there's layers
rooting for him.
Well, yeah, because you know that there is also, there's a warm side to Bill the Butcher, because he does see, so he's extremely phobic of Irish in Bill the Butcher, isn't he? He hates the Irish, but he takes an Irish lad under his wing and sees some warmth there, some love. And so you see there's layers to him. Daniel Plainview, you know he loves his son, but he's also hungry, starving for oil.
Yeah.
There's that conflict, internal conflict. In this, I'm like, I can't find that in him.
Yeah, he's just one-dimensional dickhead, right?
Yeah.
Pretty much.
The characters, but they're all so cold.
Yeah.
They're so cold. Cyril, Alma, him. It's just like, what are you watching? But, I mean, if we explain, I suppose, what it culminates up to, how it ends, is... he gets poisoned once in the film by Alma, doesn't he? and this makes him sick, and she uses that opportunity to care for him and I suppose move Cyril out of the picture as being the mother figure.
It's worth saying that Alma likes him like that. She likes him being vulnerable.
She wants to care for him.
Yeah, because he can't be his normal brutal self if he's feeling rough and he's laid out on the sofa or in bed. She can gain the power then. She's looking after him, mothering him.
So when that happens, didn't you think now you're going to go on a route where she slowly over time poisons him into a comatose state where she inherits the throne, all of that stuff? That's where I thought it was going.
Yeah, at that point I did think, okay, it's flipped it. She's now not the victim, she's the villain. Mm. And I also thought the more difficult he got, the more she's going to poison him to the point where he's like, no, I'm just going to kill this guy off.
And she wants him tender.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. But really they are on the same page of him being the child and her being the mother, which is just bizarre.
And that's the reveal, isn't it?
Yeah. That's exactly
so the reveal is when he sees her preparing mushrooms, a mushroom omelette, and as an audience, you're seeing what he's seeing, and you're also thinking he knows she's going to try and poison him. I literally thought this was going to end like There Will Be Blood. Mm. I thought, like a plain view, he was just going to beat her or strangle her, but then he knowingly eats the mushroom and her face just changes. But at this point in the film, they've got married and it started to really sour. And then he knowingly eats the mushroom, knowing full well that she's trying to make him ill. And
they
then
both want it.
Yeah, and her face changes and goes, I want you lying on your back. I want you tender. And I want you ill. And he's like, kiss me before I get too ill.
Yes.
And it just turns. That whole film you've just watched just became something really odd.
Yeah,
I was like, whoa.
It made me feel uncomfortable in my own skin. It's like, oh, you're both on this like weird journey of him being really very ill.
He wants his bum wiped.
Yeah.
He wants to be, have his tummy rubbed.
Yeah.
And
the fact that they're both in on it, if it was one of them that were in on it and the other was completely oblivious. So if Daniel Day-Lewis's character was making himself ill, so he had Alma to look after him, you'd get it. If Alma was the one that was making him ill without him knowing it, and he doesn't know why he keeps getting ill, then you get it. But the fact they're on the same twisted page just makes it very hard to digest.
The chances of two people like that meeting, I mean, you get your Fred and Rose West sometime.
Yeah.
But this is...
They deserve each other, don't they?
It's odd.
Yeah.
It's so odd. Can't believe there's a pram at the end.
Yeah, they had kids.
Can't believe they had a baby.
That kid's going to be all levels of fucked up.
The mum could be a Baron Munchausen. She could start poisoning the baby because she likes it when it's ill.
Yeah.
Starts to come some flowers in the attic. Oh, here's a fucking cake.
Oh yeah, that's a sequel I don't want to see. I also didn't like Reynolds' relatability. Considering I didn't like the character, I wasn't thrilled that I noticed a fair few similarities between myself and Lewis's character. Yeah, I can't stand noisy eaters. I too am regimented by routine. I'm easily irritable. I'm not at all flexible. And he's a difficult dude. And I didn't like realising how tricky I can be. So there was loads of scenes in that film where I'm sitting there going, oh, fuck, I do that.
Yeah.
Like I'll be eating with someone and they'll have a sloppy pasta. And if I haven't had a drink or if I'm really hungry, I zone in on that and I can't enjoy my own meal because I'm like, you're eating like a fucking dog. Get away. I can't stomach it. Mm-hmm. And that's not an appealing attribute to have, getting that wound up. And there's a scene in the film where Alma tries to surprise Reynolds Woodcock just by getting all the staff out of the house, his sister out of the house, and she was going to cook him a meal and do this lovely surprise.
Ambush.
Yeah, and he saw it as the worst thing possible. I would be the same.
Yeah, you would.
I don't like surprises. Like, one of my biggest fears is walking into a surprise party and people jumping out and I haven't prepared myself to see people. It would be horrible for me and horrible for everyone surprising me because they'd see my face drop and I'd be looking for the nearest exit.
And if you'd just left work and you hadn't showered and you walked in that room, even worse.
Yeah.
I know you.
Exactly. Or I could walk in singing Kate Nash at the top of my voice because I've had a particularly good day and then seeing like 20 of my nearest and dearest watching me. I could walk in and drop my trousers and be walking up the stairs and say, oh God, it's not worth thinking about.
Can you easily derobe? Does it take you much time to derobe?
No, not if I'm in the mood to get the trousers off.
Cool.
Yeah. But for me, there were so many things in that film, like even the scraping of toast or the eating of cereal. Or again in the film, Alma does this really nice thing of just making him a tea while he's working. And he's like, I didn't ask for tea. It's too late for tea.
Mm-hmm.
I'm that guy. I would do that shit. Instead of going, oh, thank you. In my head, I could just be like, I don't really want tea, but oh, it's a really nice gesture. In my head, I'd be like, how dare you?
Yeah, because she says, I'm leaving. I'm taking the tea out. He goes, but you're not, are you?
Yeah.
Because the interruption stays. It stays here with me.
Exactly.
Bloody hell.
Yeah, and I didn't like that I could relate so much to that character. So I need to do some changing, I think, but I probably won't. Another thing I didn't like, we touched on it a fair bit, is just the toxicity of the whole thing. I was entirely captivated by the film and I enjoyed a strong word, but I was engrossed in the 2 hours of the world of Woodcock and Co.
It's fascinating because it's so odd, strange, and dark.
Yeah, but at its core, it's a story about two enablers who manipulate one another in a bid to control. It's not healthy, and when you strip it all back, it's just two spoilt brats fighting for the upper hand, yeah. So, the film finished, and I have been thinking about it a lot, so I think it's powerful and it resonates in some ways because you are thinking, what did I just watch? What was that about? And the more you think about it, now you've given your theory with the mushrooms and the phantom thread and the mycelium or whatever that long word was that you used. All of that.
Mycorrhizal.
Yeah. All of that has made me think about it even more. So no doubt in my mind, once we finish this and I go home, I'll be thinking about the film more.
This film is reeking of fungus.
Yes, it does.
We need Paul Stamets to take a little sneaky peek into this. He did Fantastic World of Fungi.
Paul Stamets is a fungi.
Dude, you got to warn me before you drop stuff like that. it's for me, I saw mushroom. And it's just that link up. That link up between the fact that Udimantia elemosida is called porcelain. No, it's called porcelain fungus and also called poached egg fungus.
I love,
and he orders a poached egg.
I love the way you just drop that Latin word. Say it again.
Udimantia elemosida.
Oh, I love that. I just want to touch on something, actually.
Indefundibilis Geotropa.
Wow. Is that a mushroom?
Fly agaricus.
Okay, stop speaking Latin.
Oh, that's what I assume so.
Yeah. There's one thing I did like about the film, and I loved how he ordered his breakfast. So precise.
Hungry as well.
Yeah, and the way it's like ASMR, the way he was like, butter.
Two sausages.
Not strawberry jam. Raspberry jam. What else do you have? I'll have two sausages.
Yeah.
Three bacon, two poached eggs.
Welsh rabbit.
Yeah. Oh.
Bacon.
Yeah, I did enjoy that.
I liked it when he ordered porridge. I was kind of confused. He went, do we have porridge? Can we have porridge? And they go, yeah. And he goes, do we have cream? Yes. Heavy cream? Yes. And don't forget to put salt in it this time. What?
Yeah. Well, he's a mess of a man, isn't he? So it doesn't surprise me that he has salt in his porridge.
I've heard rumours. Some rumors. People.
The myth of salty porridge.
Some people put salt in porridge.
Ugh.
I've heard rumours, man. It's out there somewhere.
I once put sugar on my chips by accident. I didn't hate it.
Well, no, if you dunky chip into Milky Shake Wok, that tastes good.
That good taste,
and
nice.
That's a salty sweet.
That nice one, yeah.
Like a sweet salt popcorn.
Oh, nice. Okay, I have 3 questions. Would you like them?
Hmm.
Daniel Day-Lewis is widely regarded as one of the greatest actors to grace our screens. What is your favourite Day-Lewis performance and why?
My Left Foot, as a film, as the supporting cast, it's not...
No, but it's just not excellent. His performance,
My Left Foot, because physically, probably the most difficult one to even undertake. You know, he did draw with his foot as well. The way he physically becomes...
Sorry, I love that. You separate that sentence.
He did draw
with his foot.
Oh, well, yeah.
That's why he won the Oscar. Did he win the Oscar for My Left Foot?
Yeah, that's his first.
Oh, wow.
First one, There Will Be Blood and Lincoln. So there are his 3 Oscar films. I think he won a Golden Globe for Build a Butcher. I think Build a Butcher was Oscar worthy as best supporting.
Yeah.
Easily, because it was such an excellent character and probably one of the most more far removed characters of his choice. It's very rare he does a Gangs of New York type film, isn't it? I know it's Scorsese, but it's quite flash, quite action.
I think there's parallels between his character in There Will Be Blood and his character in Gangs of New York. It is Daniel Plainview that he plays in.
Daniel Plainview's There Will Be Blood.
And Bill the Butcher. Yeah, there's some sort of...
One's money hungry, one's race hungry. Isn't he? He's like about keeping America pure, which is such an oxymoron. To the country alone, I think when it says, 1862 Gangs New York. And so the Declaration of Independence, their country's been a country for less than 70 years, 80 years. How can you be nationalist?
Strange.
You literally are English, German, Irish. You are of that cut.
Yeah, that's weird, isn't it?
White people got to America through colonization and imperialism, but it's like, yeah, so it's a one, but where he's just, he's money power driven in There Will Be Blood. That would probably be my second.
So you're going,
actually, Last of the Mohicans does for me a lot. Michael, so you just, Michael Mann.
Just give me your favourite one right now.
My Left Foot.
Good. I would go with There Will Be Blood.
Yeah.
Personally. That's but cool. All the films, every performance I've seen him in have been phenomenal. There's not one film of his that I've seen where I was like, oh, Day-Lewis was a bit off. Like everything I've seen in him, he's been scene stealing. He's been the strongest part of, I think, all of the films I've
My
seen.
My Little
him in.
Laundrette.
I've not seen it.
He plays a homosexual guy with an Asian dude. Saw that years ago. Years ago. He's in Mutiny on the Bounty.
No. Nope.
Tiny little supporting role.
I'm not saying he's not.
I could go on.
I'm not saying he's not in it. I just haven't seen it.
No, yeah.
Okay, cool. Did Phantom Thread make you want to be a grand gentleman worthy of tailored suits and the finer things in life?
Hell no.
Did it not?
Not at all.
I did.
No.
I watched the film and I walked around my house on my own trying to speak in his well-enunciated voice. And I like the idea of having really nice suits and the finer things in life. Yeah, that appealed to me.
It made me sip tea differently.
What, pinky up?
Little pinky up. And also I had a pen behind my ear to take notes whilst watching it. And then I found that I took a bit more time in how I wrote.
Did you sketch dresses?
I didn't sketch dresses, no.
So it wasn't that impactful?
No.
Hmm.
No. I do. I've no desire to. And if that's the cold life of an artist dressmaker or House of Woodcock, House of Gucci, I wouldn't want to. And it's all what's current and what's the flavour in it of the
but
month.
It's superficial, of course it is. But
I hate catwalks and stuff. It's yeah, such but snobbish.
He
crap.
Looked sharp in that film.
Yeah, he looked good.
And so I watched that film and I wanted to order breakfast like that instead of going, oh yeah, mate, I'll have two sausage, two egg, two bacon, beans, please. I wanted to be able to be like, oh yes, I would like a two grilled sausages.
I think you should do that in this in a scaffolder pub, yeah. Calf.
In a suit.
Go in a suit, a linen suit with a cane.
Yeah. I'd get beaten up.
Welcome to Jurassic Park.
My final question is, imagine Daniel Day-Lewis is coming out of retirement for one more film. You are the director that has persuaded him to make his final ever appearance in cinema. What sort of character and role would you give him for his last hurrah?
I'd make him a serial killer in 1960s England.
No way.
Yeah.
That was my answer.
Serial?
Not necessarily 1960s, but just a serial killer.
Are you serial?
Super serial.
Oh man, Kellogg's.
100% would have him as a deranged serial killer.
Yeah.
With like similar to Kevin Spacey's character in Seven, having this really righteous motive about how awful people are and doing it because of sins, like really deep rooted reasoning and really profound sense of artistry and that he's meant to do it.
I would have gone with a castaway role where it's a one man performance, but I felt like this has been done by Mr. Hanks.
Yeah.
And I thought it would be too similar.
Yeah.
But serial killer, yeah, maybe Sutcliffe or maybe like that sort of time.
Yeah. I could see him really getting into that sort of, yeah. I wouldn't want to imagine he came out and did a Marvel film or something like that.
Never.
Oh,
he wouldn't. I honestly
don't think he'd touch
that.
I don't think
he would, no.
Well, he's retired now anyway, so. Mm. It's interesting that we both see him in a similar role for when he comes and does our film for the last thing he ever does.
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
What would you rate Phantom Thread out of 10?
6.5.
6.5? Why?
Because I didn't like the characters. Doesn't matter that it was a great performance or anything. I didn't like the characters. I don't like the fact that it's a delicate artist and their struggles with being a millionaire. And this is not a classist thing. And it's hard to fall in love or to have care or to have passion or anything for these guys.
Yeah.
They're so dark. And the fact that it all boiled down to him getting his tummy rubbed.
Yeah.
It's just so, ugh.
See, I scored it higher. Mm. I'd have gone 7.5.
Mm.
And all the sentiments you say, I completely agree with. They're not likeable.
You don't have to.
Yeah, but for me, I was fully committed to seeing how the story played out. I enjoyed the performances, even though the characters weren't likeable. I couldn't look away. And considering, like I said, it's quite a quiet film. There's no huge action set pieces or anything like that. No violence, no bust up, nothing like that. It's all very quiet. And yeah, I did. Enjoy's not the right word, but I'm glad I experienced it. And I thought the music was great. The performances was great. Amazingly directed. The whole thing worked for me. It was uncomfortable and it was meant to be. So that's why I'd give it 7.5. So that gives Phantom Thread a total score of 14 out of 20, which is pretty solid, pretty decent. I think if you like to watch films that make you feel uncomfortable, if you like to watch films that take you on many different ebbs and flows where you don't really know who you should be rooting for, if anyone, I think it's worth giving it a shot. It's quite an intelligent film. It's an interesting look into what people will do for control and power. So consider watching this one if you enjoyed There Will Be Blood, The Devil Wears Prada, and Misery.
And Fatal Attraction.
Any more?
Not Romance in the Stone. War of the Roses.
And War of the Roses. Should we play again?
Yashk.
The game in question is What the Plot, where the rules are simple and the results quite the opposite. Harry will conceive an original idea from his big and beautiful brain and give birth to a plot. It is then down to me to nurture this thought by providing a film title, genre, cast, and anything else I can think of to raise this brainchild into a fully functioning film concept. Over to you, Harry.
Yeah, I want you to imagine a Jeff Bezos-type character. Millionaire, entrepreneur, has got the world.
Billionaire.
Billionaire, trillionaire probably, you know.
Lots of money, man.
$100,000. Okay, Bezos, big old billionaire. He's done everything in life. He's, what, 55, say, approaching 60 years of age. Now, he gets early onset Alzheimer's. He gets a terrible diagnosis from the doctor that essentially, you know, Jeff, you're not going to get to spend all your money and you are probably going to die in 5 to 6 years. This changes his whole perspective on life. He no longer wants to take over the world or keep building his corporation and keep becoming this huge, the richest man on earth. He's got no interest about going into space anymore. What he does want to do, though, is reconnect with his old school friends, which he hasn't seen since his success. Ooh. So what he does without their consent or without even contacting them, he's not maintained a relationship with these guys. They're too far removed from his world now. He kidnaps all of them. They wake up on a plane mid-flight and a video comes on the screen. And it's Jeff Bezos. It's not Jeff Bezos, but it's a Jeff Bezos character.
It's a type character, yeah.
Anyway, he essentially gives them this lovely speech on a screen. They're like, guys, you're probably all wondering why you're on a plane and you just woke up here, etc. But I'm here to tell you that we're going to have the best fun ever. And essentially he goes, pick where you all want to go. And they literally, some of them are like, get me off this fucking plane. I've got kids. You know, what is going on? Even that power part of him still exists in his mortality. So it's then about him, like, taking them around the world, doing wild shit with them, cocaine, parachuting out of planes. Like, he literally says in the video, and by the way, guys, the only way you're getting off this plane is with a parachute. And then he's down on the ground for when they first get down there, and it just turns into this huge... Where if money is unlimited, and he's doing this with his mates because he knows he's going to die in 5 or 6 years, some of them might not like it. Some might be like, I was never interested in the money, Jeff. I just wanted your friendship.
Mm.
You know, it could be that's what I've got.
That's great, man. Mm. So in summary, you've got a Jeff Bezos type character who's a billionaire who finds out he's got early onset Alzheimer's or dementia. He won't keep the money. He hasn't got long to live. Like, it's quite an aggressive illness he's got, so he hasn't necessarily got long left.
He reflects.
He's focus isn't now on earning so much money and all the yachts and just expanding his business and his wealth. He's not interested in that. He wants to reignite friendship from his older, less committed days. Yeah, I love the fact that it would be sort of a film that it's about resolution between someone who's gone on the path and forgets his roots and has to sort of reconnect with friends. Are they informed when they get kidnapped to go and spend time with this Bezos billionaire that he is ill or they don't really know what's happening? Does he keep that close to his chest?
I'd say he reveals it in the last 10. I don't think he would do it soon. I think he wants to rely on him as a person to get their company, not their sympathy. So I would honestly say that he wants to take them on a wild ride. You know, some of these guys, some of them aren't successful. So one of them could be teaching, you know, primary school and stuff, and he could be really struggling with his wife and money. And then all of a sudden, you know, he wakes up on a plane. Here you go, here's a parachute. Meet me. We're about to go on one hell of an adventure. Yeah. I mean, he's got private jets, quad bikes, everything, boats, drugs, drinking. It's
okay.
Wild.
So taking that into consideration, I would say that these people that have been kidnapped to spend time with billionaire boy, they don't know why they're doing it.
No.
And I think Billionaire Boy keeps it close to his chest. He's just sort of, he's not letting on that he's terminally ill. He's just like, look, I just want to reconnect with you. And they're all probably a little bit hurt that he found this huge success and he sort of discarded them, no longer interested. So I see this as a dark comedy. There's, you know, some serious tones in it because he's dealing with dementia.
Yeah.
But it's also got to be fun, and it's got to be that about that reconnective relationship with all his own mates. Directing the film, I see Martin McDonagh directing.
Oh, no. What, Three Billboards?
Yeah. In Bruges, Seven Psychopaths. There's great comedy in his films. They're great, great comedy. Writes really funny characters. But he can also do the drama aspects really well. And in the lead, it might be bald based, but because you said Jeff Bezos.
Don't say Willis.
No.
Okay.
No. So this is going to be a British film, and I would have Mark Strong as the head honcho billionaire. I'm not going to lie.
The voice of COVID.
You said Bezos. I thought bald. That's bald. Yeah. I saw Mark Strong, who I think is a great actor.
I don't disagree with that. Yeah. No. Yeah.
And then he's band of brothers, so to speak. He's mates because it's a Martin McDonagh film. I love to see him work with Colin Farrell. So Colin would be in there.
Mm-hmm.
David Fewlis I'd have in there as well.
Love Fewlis.
Because he's great comedy, great dramatic chops as well. Yeah. I've had Idris Elba in there as well. They're all of a similar age. And I think those actors would bounce off each other.
British heavyweights.
Yeah. And Colin Firth. Because that's a solid nucleus of British talent. And I think they would all work really well together.
Which one's the alcoholic?
Colin Firth.
Yeah.
Because Colin Farrell would be the easy option.
I would have gone Fewlis for the alcoholic because he looked like he could trip over a curb.
Okay, so shall we just characterise what sort of the structure of what each actor would be?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Fewlis would be alcoholic. Colin Farrell, jealous. Used to be best mates with Mark Strong, maybe. Really
jealous,
bitter.
Injured sports star, did Irish football.
Angry, yeah. Colin Firth.
Teacher.
But the straight guy, the level-headed one.
Yeah.
Holds no real ill feeling towards Mark Strong's character. He's sort of, you know...
muddling on, he's got his wife, he's got his kids.
Yeah.
Maybe he's the guy who's quite... He's the Ed Helms in Hangover.
And maybe he's the one, because he's an intelligent guy, he clocks... that the reason why Mark Strong has got them all there.
Yes.
And I think Idris Elba would be good as the hothead. Like, he's the one that's so anti being bald there. And he really dislikes Mark Strong. Maybe they had the idea that got him famous together and he's really bitter. So you have all of them dynamics playing together. I make it, that's really
cool.
Fascinating. I'd really like to see that.
Yeah.
And I'd call the film Shortchanged.
I'm so sorry, Mr. Zazel, but it's early onset dementia.
Okay. So how much will it cost to fix it?
I only wish money could fix it, but unless you have a spare brain, there is no cure.
All right, Doc. I know exactly what I will do with the time I have left.
Why the fuck am I on a plane with you boys?
I don't know, but something tells me Zazob's behind this, the flesh kid.
If Zazob has anything to do with this, I'll rip his bald head clean off.
If the alcohol's free and just keeps coming, you won't hear me complain.
Just because I have money, it doesn't mean that I don't miss you boys.
I find it funny that you have all this money and you've been shortchanged. What? You're all thinking it.